You are listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church, located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to westhill.net/donate.
Good morning, West Hill. Good morning, West Hill. Sorry for the slight delay. We had a little traffic accident and a couple of technical problems, but I think everyone's in a nice, joyous mood by the sound of the volume in the building. Everyone's enjoying, hopefully, the sun for at least another 12 or 14 hours. We wish to acknowledge that we are on the traditional territory of the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nations lands, which lands were previously occupied by the Seneca, Huron, Wendat First Nations.
Connected to this wild and wonderful and frightening and beautiful life, to celebrate and to enter into it with a commitment to be guided in our choices by love. There are choices I make that I don't even know that I'm not making lovingly. I don't even know that I'm making a choice. I'm just living. I'm not even thinking. This place drives me crazy because I listen to something. Oh my goodness. And that's good. It just is a bump at the start. But then it's, yes, of course, I want to love that way. So getting wiser together, and getting wiser together in a non-judgmental, non-accusatory, which I don't know, if you're ever, told to change in an accusing sort of way, you shut down, back, and even if it's a good thing, and you're, so I love the atmosphere here where we celebrate being connected in a way that's loving. We encourage each other to love in a loving way. That's really outstandingly helpful to me. So let's grow in wisdom together in the web of life.
Our first reading today by Peter McMahon, who published this article in the Australian Institute of Policy and Science. New paradigm politics is about shifting scale and focus. The politics of national class are being replaced by the politics of global society. The nature of power is changing from the ability to mobilize classes and wealth to generate and sustain economic development, social stability, national security, to influencing increasingly intensive discourses on security, development, and environmental stability at a global level. The new politics is about new forms of information generation and communication, construction of spaces for debate, and translating the results of that debate into existing structures of governance, political, and commercial. The old paradigm was about things. The new paradigm is about people and information. Old paradigm politics are focused on the making and selling of products, while new paradigm politics is about information and ideas about exactly how society should work and how it should relate to the environment. The second reading. There are three types of people out there: those who lean, those who lift, and those who lead. People who lean immobilize you. Stay away from them. People who lift inspire you. Keep them near you. People who lead positively influence you. Seek them out. The third reading. I can do this. I am experienced enough to do this. I am knowledgeable enough to do this. I am prepared enough to do this. I am mature enough to do this. I am brave enough to do this. Offer it as wisdom for the journey.
May we walk in its light.
Astrology, astronomy thing, and figure out where the planets are, because clearly they're conspired against us today. Scott's computer had to get a new hard drive and a new motherboard, so everything that he normally goes to with a click needed a whole lot more, and we weren't able to manage that this morning. Our printer needs to be uninstalled and reinstalled to revamp its software, but you can't install it until the print job that it's not printing finishes. So I haven't been able to do that. But I do have everything electronically. It'll be a little bit weirder than normal for me, but hopefully we can manage to get through this together. And I think I broke the toilet over there, too, just before the service. Just saying, blame it on me. So our focus moment this morning. I was thinking about the processes that we have gone through in evolutionary ways since the beginning of time, or the beginning of whenever all of this began and how. And so I'm looking today at paradigm shifts, and we'll talk about that later in the abbreviated perspectives. You are all very chatty today, and that's absolutely fine. But think about evolution and the beginning of life on the planet as I go through this focus moment. All through the long and swaying ride across the deep, the arguments with night and day, the final triumph over light, its transformation into tissue, life found its way. All through the long and gasping crawl across the sands, the crust of fossiled dying corpses, the final triumph over air, its transformations feeding tissue, life found its way. All through the dark and storied truths we've told ourselves, the tales of angry, distant gods, their final triumphs lost to truth, their transformation into goodness, we found our way. All through our reach around this blue and precious world, we've built with love, brought down with hate, our final triumph yet unborn, our transformation into wholeness yet on its way.
I had prepared to go with your message a piano solo that would take us in a memory of a paradigm shift we had, but I'm now going to shorten it. No, I will shorten it. What it feels like to think you're fine, to find out your thought isn't, and then to get to a new and better thought. I'll shorten this. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So, yes, in the line of paradigm shifts and my going back to the beginning of life on the earth, I was reading a book about plants that featured David. It was written by David Attenborough. And when it first came out in 2003, I think it had an app that went with it, so you could actually see plants come to life in time-lapse photography over short periods of time. That app isn't working anymore. Surprise, surprise. But the book itself, I think, is one of the easiest books I've read that tells how life came to be on this planet. I mean, he just is so clear about that. And no wonder. I mean, David Attenborough's first documentary for the BBC was in, anyone know when it was? 1951. That means, like, for over 70 years, he's been doing stuff for us, helping us understand the planet. His latest one is 2019, and it's called Our Planet, Seven Worlds, in which he's looking at the seven different continents. So I haven't seen that one yet, but I'm looking forward to it. And Attenborough has this soothing, careful, intelligent way of inviting us into understanding, cajoling us into believing that the next little thing that he's going to show you is not going to be so horrifically graphic that you wish you were, you know, it was abruptly stopped before you got there. But even when you're looking at, oh my gosh, Attenborough has this way of just discussing it as reality that's playing out in this world around us, an invitation for us to understand the matrix in which we live and develop our ideas and work to bring them into being. So he is this incredible invitational force for understanding and engaging life. And I revel in the gift that he has offered us, even those ones that make me turn away from the video. I think I mentioned that ant with the fungus thing. No? Okay. Well, it's been haunting me. But he talks about the book that I'm reading came from Kew Gardens. It's a look at all of the flora that is there and its collection and its development over the history of that royal garden, which Scott and I had the privilege of seeing last year, 2 years ago, I can't remember when we were last in the UK. And we spent some time there. It was springtime. Things were kind of, no, it was the fall, and things were kind of shutting down. So it wasn't as magnificent as it might be in its full bloom in June or July. But it was wonderful to be amidst forests and lane arbors that have been planted decades ago, centuries ago, and to see them still sheltering and welcoming us into their midst. It was a beautiful time to be there. And it really helps us reflect on the nature of getting to know nature, what that has looked like over time. I mean, we lived in our own little environs for most of the history of humanity. But then as we looked at during Easter, the different ways that nature was engaged over time with classification by Linnaeus and then the understanding of heredity. Is that me dinging? It's probably me dinging. I'm just ignoring it. We have come to know nature and interact with it much more fully than we may have in the past during our, you know, established understandings of how we live. We, of course, only interacted with it early on. But as we have settled ourselves and first became agrarian and then now urban, our interaction with nature is sometimes much more compromised. I've read a lot about earthing, which is a belief that we need to ground ourselves in the earth regularly to sort of offload whatever extra static charge we have, and that most of us don't ever touch the ground, right? From one day to the next month, to the next year, we walk in on rubber-soled shoes upon asphalt. Rare, even if we're in the grass, we often have on a set of gardening clogs, again, some more plastic or rubber, and we don't actually put our bare feet on the ground.
and let go of all that energy. And so there are those who believe that that leads to wholeness and wellness and takes us back to our origins as those who ran across the terraces upon which we lived in our bare feet. I actually saw a guy jogging the other day in bare feet. He clearly doesn't have to worry about earthing because he was, I don't know why he was doing it. It was crazy. But if any of you do it, I laud you. So the rise of travel around the world and of the collecting of different kinds of specimens led to those curiosity cabinets that the Victorians loved to have. And they would be filled with rocks and minerals and shells and stuffed animals. And they would help people to come to understand what's going on in the world. But it was novelty. It was all about novelty. And having that novelty in your own house meant that, you know, you had access to the world. And those who were going and collecting it felt that they were those to whom the world had called for them to come and bring whatever it was back to their place. The book, The World Without Us, helps us understand how sometimes that planting of things that are foreign to the soil in which they're planted can, over time, take over all of the native species of plants. And World War Z, there I'm mentioning it again, Roger, I hope you're reading it. It's not World War Z, I'm wrong. I'm sorry. It was Ronald Wright's A Scientific Romance, where 500 years in the future, he sees these long green stripes in the distance. There's no people around at all. Civilization is long gone. And he's seeing these long green stripes, and so he journeys and journeys and journeys to get to where they are. And it's a substance that was sold called eco-grass that would, you know, have roots that would outroot any other kind of normal grass, all of which is foreign to us anyway, but it would outperform them, and it would kill all the weeds, and it would take over. And it has grown over all of the highways all across the United Kingdom that was in 500 years from 1999, when H.G. Wells' time machine was found and flipped forward into the future. So we moderate the space that we're on. We cultivate it and we change it. And this began in the Victorian era and earlier as those explorers brought back the gifts from across the seas. We've also had the reason that we do this, of course, is that we're trying to figure out we're not just making our houses pretty, but we're wanting to understand life. And the people who were collecting these things were generally scientists who were bringing stuff back. They weren't just going to gather the latest little thing to sell on the open market. They were bringing back and collecting information about all these different things. And, of course, we know of Darwin's journeys on the Beagle, where he went and he saw different things change and shift and came up with new understandings and ideas about them. And that invited us into some paradigm shift talk. So I'm going to go back to the paradigm shifts. The first paradigm shifts, if we're talking about humankind, some of the big things, I've just mentioned a couple. One is that we no longer have to chase our food. We can actually plant it and then reap it and stay here, and we can be safe. And on Easter, I believe I read Neil Gaiman's poem about the mushroom hunters, how women learned to cultivate the space around them, to find those herbs and vegetables and things that were growing that they could then plant themselves so that we could be healthy. And they were the first scientists because they learned how to cook those things in ways that wouldn't kill us. It was a significant and important thing. And Gaiman's poem shares that understanding of women as the first scientists in a beautiful and powerful way. But as humankind, once we stopped merely chasing our food but also started cultivating it, it meant that we could create communities that were larger than they had been, because you couldn't all survive on one antelope. The number of people that would feed was limited, but if you were planting foods, you could grow a much larger community as well. And our brains, large enough to hold the kinds of connections that we do, as those with large frontal lobes always do, we have bigger tribes.
And so our tribe could be bigger because of that cultivation. So that's one of the early paradigm shifts in human development. But if I want to get to a little more contemporary time, and by this I'm talking about, the 10th century, we started the scientific process. We started looking at the world scientifically instead of just something that we could eat or that would kill us or a place that we could get water or not. We started asking our questions about ourselves. And the first time that this happened was in the 10th century, a Muslim physicist, Al-Hazan. And I'm a bit concerned that this is a Western article that I was reading, and so it doesn't take into account Asian understandings, and which are very, very deep, and so that may have informed some of this as well. But a Muslim physicist, Al-Zahran, started looking at the world in a scientific way, trying to understand why things were there and how they changed and what we could do with them. And we spoke on Easter about medicinals and how we learned about medicinals and were able to take care of ourselves. And one of the next big shifts took place in was Newtonian, okay? Classical mechanics. Anybody know about Newton? Grade 11 physics? Yes, good. Okay, that was the next big one. We figured everything operated in sync in some way. One thing powered another. One could send energy from one place to another. We could figure out how things work just by exploring the mechanics of them. And then, of course, the next another shift was Gregor Mendel, who we spoke about on Easter Sunday too, and that was about genetics. That was a huge different understanding of the world. And then we go into quantum theory and all kinds of things like that. So those are the big, some of the big paradigm shifts in human development. But there are thought paradigm shifts as well. And I was going to ask you, can you think of things that we would have come to understand that changed the way we saw the world? And I'll give you an example. One of the very first things that changed, and not one of the very first things, that's a ridiculous thing. I didn't mean that. Take that out, whoever's recording this. One of the crucial things that we came to learn as we journeyed this earth as human beings was that the earth was not the center of the universe, right? There are still people who think it's flat, you know, but most of us don't think that it's the center of the universe anymore. That thought was held so deeply and so deeply entrenched in how we understood ourselves, as well as the Earth and the planets and the orbits to which we are, that it was held on to far after it had been proven that we were not at the center of the universe, with all of the applications of the challenges to individual lives and freedoms that remarking that it wasn't the center of the universe brought about. But there were a couple of other ones that I found really, really interesting as I was exploring paradigm shifts, as I gathered information for today's perspectives. And one of them, this was in an article by Francesco Galati, and he noted a transportation paradigm shift, the shift from using animals for transportation to mechanical transportation. And that was a huge change. And he put some pointers about why that was so urgent in his article. And he's thinking mostly about New York City here. So think about, you know, horse and carriage in New York City. We're talking about the need to find an easier way to remove the average of 41 dead horses a day on the streets of New York. We also needed some place to relocate the 1,200 metric tons of manure produced each day and someone to do the relocating of that manure. And we needed to figure out how we were going to stable the 100,000 plus horses that operated within New York and provide the food to feed them. And when we think about that, we're thinking of a much smaller New York City than we have today, right? Imagine if we were still plodding around on hooved horses or some kind of animal transportation and the challenges that that would make to us, to say nothing of the horrific challenges that it presented to the animal world. But that's a big change. And
we would never have grown to the size of New York City as it is now without the kind of mechanical automobile transportation that we had. The whole conversation about who made the transportation systems work and who profited from it, that's another story, and it's very interesting, and we'll go there another day. But another, I'm not going to ask you for this because we don't have time to go through the questions, but anyway, the next one is the definition of a person. And the thought shifts around that. A definition of a woman. The definition of a slave. The identification as a slave as human. And the definition of a woman as human. Does anyone know the last country on earth, I mean, aside from those that are still caught in theological paradigms that do not provide women rights, the rights that we understand, but there was a democratic country that was the last one to recognize women as persons? Switzerland. You want to know when? Well, it was long after David Attenborough started his programs, 20 years into his career as a documentarian. 1971, Switzerland recognized women as persons and allowed them to vote. Yes, interesting. So if we were to look at, and this is where I want to go today, is about political paradigms. And no, churches are not allowed to talk partisan politics, but they can talk politics. I'm on solid ground here. But the political paradigm shifts that we've seen over the course of the human history that we recall are early on, there was the wealthy and the poor, and that in Greek society and Roman society, the development of a king or an emperor who was understood to be the equal of God or gods. And then that sort of morphed over time into the feudal system where we had a king and the rights given by the king to certain individuals who were lords over certain areas, which then, you know, finally got down to those who were digging in the dirt for their daily sustenance. So that feudal system was one upon which much of the conquered world experienced. When we were in Hawaii and I got to know the history of Hawaii, you know, those same feudal sorts of situations were unfolding in the Southwest Pacific, long before they ever made contact with what was going on in much of the other imperial countries. So that idea of a leader as a god king individual and everything that falls out of that, the divine right of kings and blah, 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 is a system that has ruled much of contemporary human development. That gave way to democracy? Democracy. It gave way to democracy. And in democracies, individuals have a right to have something to say about the governments that will lead them. And they vote people into power. And those individuals exert that power in ways that the people have enabled them to do by giving them the power. And so democracies have functioned in most Western countries for a couple hundred years at least, if not more. But then there's this new one that's happening, which I don't think, it's kind of like the United Church deciding to lift up particular parts of its theology as being the right ones without actually asking the democracy of the wider church. And the wider church is not a democratic institution, it's a conciliar institution. But we go to the councils and ask them for their insight on that. And that hasn't happened over the last few years because it's shifting and changing. The power has shifted and changed. And so, too, in our own democratic societies, the power seems to have shifted and changed, too, because there are others who are not the individuals who have the democratic right to elect their governments, who are actually influencing those governments. So who are those persons who are influencing governments now? Any idea? Sorry? Corporations.
You're right. Corporations who are identified as persons. And so they have incredible power. They don't vote in the same way that a person does, but they have incredible power over politicians who are elected to office and influence their decisions either through contributions or through favoritism or through backroom, whatever goes on in those backrooms. And so they have sort of had quite a significant influence over our democracies. And the other thing that has happened is we have moved from those, you know, we have local governments, we have regional governments, some of us, we have provincial governments or state governments, we have countrywide governments, but we also now have seen a shift to a global government, except that it's kind of lacking government. And we've shifted into this global world, which I don't think any of us were quite prepared for. And our institutions certainly have not shifted and morphed in order for us to engage in that environment in any kind of a significant way. And that's as far as my notes go. Now I'm going off record. But I do want to look at one more piece before we... I've lost it. Randy, could you find the readings for me? Thank you. You may have to go into my email or wherever. I don't know. So we're in a situation now where the political parties that we believe we understand and who we vote in to guide our democratic responsibilities, to take them upon themselves, are no longer really as simple and as clear as we believed they may have been 60 or 70 years ago. I don't know that they were, but we believed that they were. And global corporatization hadn't yet happened at that point in time. We had combines legislation that refused to allow the amalgamation of large corporations in order to give you the right to choose one corporation over another, the goods of one over another, the opportunities that one offered over another. But that compliance legislation must have changed since I took that law course. But now we see these incredible amalgamations of corporations, and we realize that as we make a choice against one product for another, it may be the same corporation that owns it, and we just don't know. Oxfam, a couple of years ago, put out a map of corporate logos, which tied dozens, if not hundreds, of corporate logos to five companies that owned all of them. It was profoundly shocking to see that. So even as you think you're making choices at the supermarket, you're not really making choices at the supermarket because they're all coming from the same pockets or heading into the same pockets. And that corporatization has allowed this incredible wealth to accumulate in the pockets of a few rather than be redistributed, thank you, amongst the pockets of the many. I listened to a podcast that of a perspective that I shared back in 2011 this week, and I was reflecting on a map of the city that had been made by the Social Planning Council, which had noted that in 20 years, the percentage of the middle class had gone from 89% to 29%. That the pop in Toronto, the middle class was disappearing at an incredible rate, and the lower classes were growing. The higher classes were being centralized. So those kinds of maps and that kind of change is profound and challenging, and we're not prepared to deal with it, to respond to it appropriately. Some of us who have watched what's been going on in Ontario, particularly those who voted for the Conservative government, they voted for a Conservative Party that they thought they knew. And the Conservative Party they thought they knew had been hijacked without their really knowing it into this this organization that is doing things that both my neighbors who voted for it would never have expected to have happened. And we didn't see that coming because we think we can trust the systems that have been handed to us. So
So this week, the last 2 weeks, I've been talking about climate change as the dream that we have to lift up, the dream that has been, that people have died for over the last half century, trying to bring about our awareness. And I posted to Facebook, did you see, remember last week I was talking about when we first heard about climate change or when we first saw the study about that, it was 1958. Well, it was actually in the 1870s, I think, that a woman, I posted that Ms. Foote, who was a scientist, put different gases in jars and put them out in the sun and found out that carbon dioxide was the one that heated up the fastest. And so that was the beginning of the understanding that, you know, what blankets the earth is actually blanketing it and keeping the warmth from getting out. But where was I? Okay, I got off on a tangent. My apologies. So we were talking about democracy and how it shifts and changed. And last week, because we were talking about climate change, I wanted to move into the conversation that's now taking place around Green New Deals. It started taking place here in Canada, but it began in the United States with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who many of you know is this perky young congressional representative from the Bronx. And she swept into power over someone who had been elected and reelected and reelected since 1999, I think, he had been the representative from that area. And because I wanted to talk about this stuff, when Netflix popped up that there was a new documentary on it, I watched it. And it was a documentary that was showing that people were organizing across the country. Organizations were inviting people from every Democratic state, wherever a Democratic seat was held, to find new voices, new people who would actually challenge those who were sitting at the time and were sitting predominantly on privilege, who were not actually voting in favor of legislation that would help their neighborhoods. So the one that Alexandra, AOC, first noted in a conversation with some of her constituents, which is on the documentary, she notes, she says to them, do you know where he lives, this guy who was the representative there? You know where he lives? And I said, well, here. No, he lives in Virginia. He's representing New York, but he lives in Virginia. And when asked that question, when he finally agreed to debate Alexandria, she said something about him not living there. And he goes, well, I want to protect my children. I want to keep my children out of this. Which kind of suggests that he doesn't have a lot of respect for the place that he's leading. And this is where I want the reading again, because the reading that Randy gave and the quote that showed up on the slide that was from AOC, I'm always going to get that wrong, was part of the documentary. And she's sitting on her couch in her tiny little apartment. She's been working as a bartender and a waitress because her family was about to lose their home, so she was trying to save her home for her mother. And so she's in this tiny little apartment with her partner, and she's sitting there going like this. And her partner goes, what are you doing? I'm trying to take up space. I'm trying to get bigger. Like, I want to take up space, because she's heading to this debate that night. And she's aware that she's debating someone who's been a politician for years, and somebody just nominated her. It was actually her brother, unbeknownst to her. And then they went through all these nominations, and they checked them out, and they interviewed, and they talked to them, and they came up with a few that they were really going to put forward. And she was one of them. So she's a bartender, and then she's got a paper bag behind the bar from which she's running her entire campaign. Is from a little paper bag hidden behind the bar. So she's going to this debate. And if anyone's been on a televised debate, it's not a comfortable place to be. You can be as confident as you want, and somebody can throw you a question, and you either turn bright red, or you answer in a way that you think is inappropriate, or you don't know the answer and you look like a fool. So Alexandria is sitting there, and her partner says, so what do you do? I'm trying to take up space. I'm trying to be big. And then she stops and she says, I can do this. And he says, I know you can. And that's when she says, I am experienced enough to do this.
I am knowledgeable enough to do this. I am prepared enough to do this. I am mature enough to do this. I am brave enough to do this. And what she said after that is, and he's going to be telling me that I'm not. We don't think we have that power. We don't think that we have a right to demand a change. We don't think that we can change a system that isn't working anymore. And it'll be a long time before the system is changed. But that one person who got voted in New York, who shut out a candidate whose family had been entrenched in politics and who had grown his power by his engagement with corporations, that one small voice, a woman who at 28 took that seat, indicates there's change that can come. After she's been elected, she's sitting in front of Congress and she's got her head down and she's thinking and she looks up and she said, you know, when I was a kid, my father was going on a road trip, and these are not her exact words, obviously, but my father was going on a road trip with his buddies and I wanted to go with him. And he kept saying, no, you can't come with us, but I want to go. Finally, he said, okay, you can come. And so there were 4 grown men and a 5-year-old girl. And they went to Washington. That was one of the places that they went, was to Washington. And her father walked her around that place. He died when she was 17. But she has this memory of him walking her around Washington. And everything she saw, he said, you know, that belongs to us. This is our government. So it belongs to us. Everything you see here is yours. Which I thought was so beautiful. But we forget that. It's ours. It doesn't belong to the politicians that are in there. It doesn't belong to the corporations who may have them in their pockets. It doesn't belong to lobby groups. It belongs to us, right? And we have the right to demand, to speak, to offer opportunities for it to shift and change according to the needs that we perceive. And so groups are beginning to get together around the idea of Green New Deals here in Ontario to find out ways that we can bring the issue of climate change to the fore, where we can talk about future generations and not choke up because we think we're not leaving them a world in which they can live. Or when you see someone who's pregnant thinking, oh my goodness, not knowing how that child will find the peace and affluence that we have known and probably will never have. It starts with someone saying, I can do this. It starts with our recognizing that the old structures are no longer the structures that we want to support. I went to a party meeting a couple of weeks ago, and maybe a month ago, and I'm not saying what party it is, you note that, I'm not saying what party it is, and I sat there, and I was the only person in the room who had never been there before. They all knew each other. So they ignored me totally. They talked in talk, they talked about names, about people, they laughed about some things, all in jokes, didn't even wonder if I wanted to know what they were talking about. So change has to happen. We have to find ways to shift the paradigm of power into something that is engaging and something that can hear from the bottom up, something that can transform the way we lead our cities, our provinces, our country and the world. And it is embedded in your hearts and minds. It's embedded in the conversations that you have to share. It's embedded in the opportunities that you provide to the people around you and to yourself. So find that paradigm shift, get it rolling, and make it something that will inspire others, that will help bring about the world that we want to leave to those who will come after us. Thank you. I generally send you out of here. I'm going to send you to lunch, which is in that room. And I hope that you're able to stay for us, stay with us. But I send you out into a world that is absolutely unfinished. And it is ours to craft and create. And so I send you out there with the courage within yourselves to find that courage, to find the permission, to find the voice, to find the opportunities to continue the work of creating this world so that what emerges is something of which we might all be proud, something that might leave a legacy of our love for future generations. Go from this place into lunch in peace.
What call would justice make? What path would kindness take? What would a little more wisdom see? What would courage set free? What would compassion say? What might just save the day? These are all questions. What would love do now? What would love do now? What would...
You have been listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church located in Scarborough, Ontario, Canada. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners, volunteers, and members of our community. To donate, go to our website, www.westhill.net, and click on the Canada Helps button, or go to www.westhill.net/donate.